Well, a very good Monday morning to all of our podcast listeners for Inside Lane, a podcast that is taking you through the World Athletics Championships. And I'm here with Dr. Ross Tucker, who's on Twitter at Science of Sport. He's got millions of followers on Twitter. And a big thank you to everybody that's been part of the conversation over the last few days. We looked at some of the stats this morning. We reached 500,000 people over the last three days of our podcast. So thank you for everybody for participating and airing your comments, not only on Twitter, but also on Facebook Live. We've had some questions on there, and we've had some great downloads for our podcast as well. So we're glad you're enjoying it. One of the things that I guess we've enjoyed it, but to some extent there's one part we haven't enjoyed, and I know, Ross, we talked about this in the preview podcast last Tuesday. We were trying to avoid the subject of drugs. So I think we're going to say this right now before we continue the rest of the podcast. We're a little sick and tired of talking about drugs. We want to celebrate the sport of athletics, and we want to make sure that people are enjoying it with us. But we want to put almost a disclaimer out there and say, we know it's there. We know it exists. We've talked about it ad nauseum the last few days. We're going to try and avoid it. We're going to try. So if people are saying, looking at it and saying, why don't you talk about, you know, these sort of suspicious results, this is why. We're going to try and avoid the subject because we do want to celebrate the performance of the athletes here.
Yeah, so if I could say two things. One is, we're not softballing doping, so please don't message and say you're neglecting XYZ. We've spoken about the obvious cases. I mean, Gatlin winning 100 makes it very difficult to not talk about doping.
Yeah.
Farrow winning a 10,000 makes it very difficult to not talk about it because he's got two coaches and they're both under police or FBI or anti-doping investigation. So how can you avoid it? But there are going to be winners, and there have been winners, and you can't talk about every gold medal and say, but they're probably doping. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. So we're not ignoring it, but we don't want to force the issue down your throats because it means that we neglect certain events and we don't do justice to all the technical and tactical aspects. So if it's part of the story, we're going to tackle it head on.
Yeah.
But we're not going to go and look for it just to be poking the same old bear. You know? And it's going to come up today.
Yeah.
Having said we're going to avoid it, it's going to come up today because we're going to address it. But I hate the whataboutery, you know?
Yeah.
If you talk about this, then someone... I mean, I tweeted about Ayana's amazing 10,000 and I've had 20 Ethiopians saying, what about Farrow and Radcliffe? Well, what about them? We're talking about them all the time.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about the events and we'll deal with doping when it's in the story.
So it's kind of a disclaimer we're putting out there today and saying that we're not ignoring it, but we're trying to be positive. I think that's what we're looking at.
Yeah.
So just before, this is kind of a segue towards the wrap-up of the weekend. And if you haven't listened to our podcast on Saturday and Sunday, you would have picked up some of the stuff we were talking about. But obviously yesterday there was a tactical maneuver by the IAAF when Gatlin was given his medal. The IAAF claims that they had an administrative error. Therefore, the prize giving for the 100 meters happened just before everybody arrived at the stadium and about 10 minutes before the live broadcast. They claim administrative error. And if you can see us live on the podcast, I'm going to put that in italics because it was quite clearly a tactical move because they were worried about the reaction of the crowd once he got up there to get his medal.
Yeah, because that 100 meter medal ceremony was supposed to be what?
It was supposed to be an hour into the evening's event.
Yeah, and it was supposed to be the coronation of King Bolt in his final ever individual event. So they put it as a prime time slot because Ko was going to give the medal to Bolt and everything was going to be happy day, as good as defeated evil. And that's the problem. Yesterday we said the moment they created that simplified narrative, good versus evil, they created the possibility for the worst possible ending.
Yeah.
And they got the worst possible ending and then they made an administrative error. Well, Gatlin made an administrative error when he got caught positive for doping.
So twice.
Two administrative errors. Yes. Third one by the IAAF. It's those guys have been scrambling to try and undo the damage done by Gatlin's win. And I love it. I think it's great because they couldn't have gotten anything other than that. It's what they deserved.
It was. I mean, not that I ever want to make light of the situation, but there was an element of humor. Now, you wouldn't have seen it live on the broadcast purely because they made sure it happened before you actually saw the live pictures, but you could YouTube it. And there's this moment where Seb Coe, who looks like some, I always think Seb Coe looks a bit like a superhero because he's got that bit of grey in his hair, you know, he looks like he should be one of the superheroes.
The alter ego of a superhero.
He does. Yeah. Kind of standing there quite stoically. You know, he's been very vocal about the fact that the worst result for the IAAF and for World Athletics is for Gatland to win. And he was the one who actually had to hand over the medal. So it was it was really just it was comedic in a way.
Yeah, they bet the house on Bolt, you know. They bet, and by house, I mean they bet the reputation and the credibility of the championships.
Yeah, yeah.
And on day two, they lost their currency.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, anyway.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the marketing of athletics and ask the question a little bit later on about, is athletics in crisis at the moment with Bolt leaving the sport and what's the future of the sport looking like? But before we do that, let's just wrap up this weekend's results. Obviously, the men's 100, we've probably talked about that. There's been plenty written about it.
Yeah.
The women's result yesterday, the Olympic champion loses it. She is the overwhelming favourite. I would have bet your house on the fact that she would have won that. But she loses it, and not only does she lose it, she finishes fifth. And it was quite an. It was probably one of the biggest shocks of the whole championships.
Yeah, especially because, unlike the men's 100, there was, you know, in the men's 100 there was so much uncertainty even after the semi-finals because nobody looked standout. In the women's 100 semis, Thompson looked superior. She looked so easy. She ran as fast a time in the semi as it would have taken to win the final, coasting the last 20 meters. And so, you know, she's been there at the Olympics. She's done these rounds and finals. It's not as though she's inexperienced. She shows up in the final and she's there, and then she finishes fifth. So that was a big surprise. That was really a big surprise. So
She had some problems. So as you tweeted last night, she looked like she basically ran over some marbles halfway down the finishing straight. I mean, any ideas about what happened there?
Some, and I mean, we're speculating wildly, but like, why not? That's the beauty of sport. At about 50 meters, so she's come out of the blocks, everything's going maybe not quite according to plan, because Thompson is super quick out the blocks, and her acceleration phase is by far the best. So normally, at 30, 40 meters, she's ahead, and she wasn't this time, so maybe that's a hint of something there. But she'd run in London a couple of weeks ago in the Diamond League meeting, and had chosen on that occasion to not use the spikes. Now, the spikes, I'm looking at our shoe wall here, we don't have track spikes, but spikes have got a very stiff carbon fiber plate, and that stiffness loads the Achilles tendon, whereas normal flat shoes don't do that as much, they're a bit more flexible. Mm-hmm. And so she's had this Achilles problem that she was trying to protect a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
And when she got to 50 meters, it's like, I'm sure you've done this, I've done it many times, is if you're walking, say, down a staircase, and you get to the bottom, but you think you've still got a step to go, and you take that next step, then suddenly you jolt because it's as if the earth comes up too quickly.
Yeah,
she looked like that had happened. And so I was on Twitter, as you say, and a doctor, a South African sports physician, tweeted to say, often when people have an Achilles thing, it just pings as though someone's thrown a stone or something sharp onto their Achilles, and that's typical. So it wouldn't surprise me if she withdraws from the 200, that'll be telling. She didn't make excuses afterwards, but she is the Olympic 200 meter champion. But it wouldn't surprise me if she pulls out, and that would tell us that yes, in fact, whatever niggle she was carrying has just caught her halfway through her third race. You know?
And I mean, I suppose if you're a sprinter, to rupture your Achilles is kind of a career-ending thing. So if you think something's wrong with your Achilles psychologically, I guess that plays in you. If you feel it halfway through the race under such load, you know, you go into sort of almost a catch phase, I suppose, and you're running.
Any of these elite events, you know, but especially the forces and the load, you're talking five times body weight. Mm. The sprint is in contact with the ground for 0.09 of a second per foot strike.
Sure.
And so the force in that small time, I mean, the rate at which you're loading those joints is enormous.
Yeah. I mean, there's amazing pictures of these long jumpers that actually break their legs because of the forces that go through their legs.
And triple jump as well. So that's a shame for her. It's a shame for Jamaica. So Jamaica only got one medal in the 200 meters, only Bolt. And that's the first in a long time. First time since 2003. So that's 10 events, Olympics and Worlds, that a Jamaican woman has not got a medal in the 100. So that's so they'll be disappointed in that. They're not having the greatest championship so far, that's for sure.
Well, maybe the world just turns, I guess, you know. It's
just cycles, yeah.
But what's interesting is that in the women's 100 metres, we had an athlete from Côte d'Ivoire who finished second, Tori Bowie. And, I mean, that was... Let's just talk a little bit about that the people that won this instead of those that lost.
Mm.
Tori Bowie, I guess she was up there. She was a middle hope. Mm. Dipped at the line, just beat Tula into first place. How much is that dip worth in real terms?
Well, enough to change the medal.
Mm.
Because... with 5 meters to go, and dare I say, with 1 meter to go, that medal is going to the Ivory Coast. Mm. And it's interesting because in the men's race, we spoke yesterday morning about Bolt and Coleman were going at it in 4 and 5, and Gatlin was in 7. And could the fact that Gatlin was unsighted have played a role? And I don't think so, because they were going so fast as they could.
Mm.
But in this instance, Talu was pretty well clear of anyone around her, and Bowie was maybe unsighted. She, not entirely. I mean, it's not like you can't see to the side.
Mm.
But I do wonder if they'd been adjacent, like next to one another, whether Talu would have thought a little bit more to dip. Because she crossed the line dead upright.
Yes.
And you can find the photograph. I'm sure you'll find it on Twitter. Otherwise, go to the IAAF website and you'll find it.
Yeah.
But the dip, but Bowie's getting... you know, 5 or 6 centimeters, and that's the difference in the photograph.
So just for those that are new to athletics, obviously the point that the measurement is taken is across the line, is across the chest. So that's why the dip is so important. Mm. And I know a lot of the top athletes, they do practice that dip in training, because it's not easy to do. I mean, if you actually go onto a track and actually practice a dip yourself as a normal runner, it's quite a difficult thing to do, to suddenly lean your body forward while you're in full sprint. So it's something that has to be mastered. And at that level, it's probably quite a critical thing, because it is that hundredth of a second.
Well, it's the decisive thing, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why they practice it. But it happens a lot that an athlete doesn't dip on the line. And and maybe you're in the moment and 80,000 people and you're thinking about 10 other things. And that's the one you neglect. And now you're going to... I mean, she must... She was happy to medal, because she came, I think, 4th in the Olympics. And good for her, because, I mean, I don't know how many medals the Ivory Coast have won, but that's got to be unique.
Especially
there.
Sprinting, yeah.
So good for her, but there'll be some regret there. But she's got a good shot at the 200, so maybe she can make up for it.
I mean, there's no doubt that she was leading, literally, as you said, until that last meter.
Yeah.
And I do suspect that she thought she had it. And it's in that split second you have to make that decision. So
exactly.
Controversy and some surprises. And I think, you know, that's one thing that's been a feature of these World Championships so far, is that there has been a lot of shocks. 800 metres last night, goodness me, that was like carnage, wasn't it?
Carnage. So 800 is always like that, because it's the fastest tactical race.
Mm.
I mean, the 400 is tactical in the sense that you can go out too aggressively, and if you do that, then you explode in the last 100 and you'll be running through syrup while everyone else is leaving you behind.
Mm.
But 800 is properly tactical, because there's a possibilities of being boxed in, and you have to make decisions which have lasting consequences, because it's so quick that if you make a bad decision, you don't make up for it.
Mm.
And so and also there's this physiological challenge. You run a heat and then a semi and so on. And so it always throws up some surprises.
Mm.
But last night was chaos, because the world number one went out, apparently carrying a slight injury from his previous race. So there's that. But 6 of the top 9 in the world were in those semis and went out.
Mm.
And so only 3 of the world's top 9 made it to the final. So that is now wide open.
Any theories as to why that happened? I mean, is it all individual cases of race?
I think so. You had the Kenyan Correa, who's world number one, had apparently a hip flexor injury, and he looked it when he was running. He didn't look like he was moving anything like as smoothly as normal. So there's that, and then there's tactical errors, and it's weird. I mean, I was a very average 800 meter runner, and I know the feeling is
what was your best?
Oh, when I was at school, 157.
It's not bad.
Well,
you didn't ride up there with Caster.
Not even on the podium.
Still not bad.
And you know, that's how it goes, is you can get to 100 to go in really, then you're going to run the perfect race and you just have nothing in the last 100. And that happened to a couple of guys yesterday. Looked like they'd gotten in good positions and had nothing there. So it's wide open. Rhodesia pulled out just before with an injury. And so none of the Olympic medalists are there. and six of the world's top nine are now also not there. So tomorrow night's the final for that. So that'll be really interesting.
Somebody's going to get lucky.
Yeah. So the favorite. So the favorite now must. Well, I say this, but Nigel Amos of Botswana is the fastest guy left.
Sure. Okay.
If you watched the heats yesterday, he was in the first one, and he tactically was appalling.
Mm.
So the interesting thing is, you know, just before they hit the final bend, they got 250 to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's often the key moment, because everyone wants to make their move there so that you can get into the best possible position
on the
inside for the final 200 meters.
Yeah.
And so Amos was in a really good position with 200 to go. And then Adam Kaszot of Poland, who's probably the second favorite going into the final, came past him along with a couple other guys. And suddenly Amos, within 2 seconds, goes from having a really good position to a really bad one, because now he's about to hit the bend. He's been boxed in and he's lying fourth or fifth. And chances are another few guys are going to come by and he's going to have to do a lot of work. So decision number one. Mm. Then he makes the decision. He basically sidestepped like Raymond Rule on the wing for the box. I say he almost stopped. I mean, I'm exaggerating. He finds himself in about lane 2.5 on the bend and he's working unbelievable. It's such a waste of energy. He ran a dreadful tactical race, and if that happens in the final, he's not getting a medal.
So that
shows you that physically, physiologically, I reckon he's the best guy.
Yeah.
But tactically, if he does that, he's beaten by.
I suppose that's the beauty of the advantage, isn't it? It isn't just about who's the fastest. There is tactical reasons for it.
Yeah,
I remember
exactly.
Speaking to the great South African 800 meter Hezekiel Sepeng during his prime in the 90s, and he explained to me the one day that if you're running an 800. You've got a finite amount of energy and speed, and how you apportion that out over the race determines your results. So
exactly.
If you go out really, really hard in the first lap, you're going to suffer in the second. So you have to make sure that you're and if you have to do too much by going around somebody, that extra bit of work, that 2% is the difference between a medal and not a medal. So it's a fine line, because they are so on the edge of their performance limits that they literally, if they make a mistake, that's it.
And that's the performance limit bit is probably true of all events, but the key in the 800 is that you have one mistake to make.
Yeah.
And if it's a big one, it's one too many. Mm. You can maybe make one small one.
Mm.
But if you lose concentration once in the 105 seconds, then you go from perfect position to worst possible position, and there's nowhere back.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think my 800 is my favorite event in athletics. I think it's an absolutely marvelous event to watch because of that. And it's such a fine line. Let's talk a little bit about athletics in general. We saw this weekend, you know, Gatlin's result obviously wasn't a good thing for the IAAF. We've had a couple of questions talking about where's athletics globally now.
Yeah.
Do you think it's in crisis? I mean, there's been so much talk about drugs. There's been so much talk about Gatlin's environment. And Lord Seb Coe, who is the man in charge of World Athletics with the IAAF, has made a couple of comments saying that they need to be, you know, that athletics needs to be relevant down the line. Is it facing a crisis now that Bolt is gone?
Just on that, there's a question here on our Facebook from Tony Flynn saying, has the IAAF explained yet how Justin Gatlin caused Elaine Thompson to lose? So he's the scapegoat, right? And even the way you phrase that question is like, is it in crisis? Gatlin's the champion.
Yes. Gatlin's the bad boy for everything. You blame Gatlin for everything.
Yeah.
It's a good quote. It's a good question there.
Yeah, so that's Tony Flynn. I think I said his name there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we see dwindling attendances in the Diamond League, I think. My impression is.
Even the big events like Oslo are not full.
But then I watch rugby a lot, and I see decreasing attendances there.
Mm.
I know that in the NFL, they're having problems with attendances.
Mm.
I went to a conference a few years ago, and I'm answering your question very circularly.
Mm.
But the owner of one or two of the NFL teams were there, and they said the biggest threat to their sport was television, because the quality of TV is so good, HD TVs and three-dimensional, 3D and so forth, that people are now able to experience much more from home than they used to do. So is that the case for track and field? I doubt it. Mm. I mean, it's not as though they're putting you in the race. Maybe that is the future.
No, there's not a lot of technology in TV broadcast around athletics, I think.
To some extent,
actually quite lacking.
Yeah, so maybe that's an area where they can take one or two steps forward without having to fundamentally change the sport.
Yeah.
Because once you leave that, then you're left with questions around the existential survival of track and field. Mm. As in, are people buying into it. And one of the, I mean, you and I have spoken about this many times. Mm. I think one of the problems with track and field is that unless you've done it, it's very difficult to relate to it.
Mm.
So, and that means that there's a societal problem, because how many people today are doing track and field at school compared to how many were doing it 15, 20 years ago? It's because physical education or PT or whatever you call it, wherever you are in the world, that's largely been relegated from schools. Mm. Certainly here in South Africa, maybe it's not where. So you're watching the marathon yesterday, and you're seeing the decisive moves in the women's race, and they're running 16 minutes for 5Ks. What does that mean? You know, so there's no appreciation of what that actually meant. Mm. And so because people don't do, they can't relate. And that's part of the problem. It's not relatable.
Yeah.
And then I think the other one, and Co said that doping is not the sport's biggest issue.
Mm.
He said the credibility and relevance are. I don't see how credibility and doping exist separately.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing, right? Yeah. Relevance, maybe not.
Mm.
But doping, I mean, the fact that these world championships, the discussion points are Gatlin, Dope, Farah, question marks, and so on, that tells you doping is one of the sport's big issues, and they haven't addressed it.
Mm.
Now, before we came on air here, you said, so what about doping? Like, people don't really care. And that's an interesting issue.
Well, because in cycling, I mean, cycling's been, you know, if anybody had to pinpoint a sport that's got the most publicity around doping, it's cycling, and yet it's more popular than ever. So I always question, oh, it's terrible for the sport when there's doping, but, and I suppose, you know, is there any such thing as bad publicity? You know, Gatlin might be the bad guy, but people will still go and watch him because maybe they like to boo him and be part of it.
I'll tell you what, I think, well, at the time it was my impression, and again, I've got no data for this, so this is a very bald assertion, but in 2005-06, cycling went through maybe its lowest point, maybe just after Landis got exposed, because he was the first yellow jersey to fail a test. We now know Armstrong and all the other guys who were likely or definitely doping who had yellow, but he was the first one to lose the jersey because of a positive. And I remember at that time, media in Europe said, we're not going to cover the sport anymore. German, I think Swiss, those newspapers didn't carry the tour.
Yeah.
They carried the doping stories. And that was a stimulus to change things from the marketing and the money point of view. But until that stimulus exists, there's no incentive to catch doping. Yeah. So
do you still believe that the administrators of the sport, both in internationally and generally, are not taking it seriously enough? I mean, is that your assertion? That
doping specifically?
Yeah.
Yes. And that's not even my words. That's Richard Pound is a Canadian lawyer who was the first head of the World Anti-Doping Agency. And he is on record, and this quote exists, I'm not making this up, he is on record as saying that there is no appetite to catch doping. There are other people in the know who have said that the World Anti-Doping Agency is basically a PR arm, because it exists to create the illusion that doping matters to sports agencies. National anti-doping federations have no incentive to expose their own athletes. And of course, that's what's required. So the way the whole system is set up might have been good 15 years ago for what existed then, but it's clear now that it's not fit for purpose, to use a businessy jargon term. And so then you'd say, okay, they're not really serious about it, because if they were, they would expose a level of cheating, I think, that would actually possibly mess the sport up completely. But maybe it wouldn't, you know?
Yeah. People, you realize we're talking about doping again.
I know, but people don't...
We tried.
Okay, well, 30 seconds. People don't... In the USA, people don't care about doping in baseball. You know, there's quotes as well. People would rather see 60 home runs a year and batters in baseball smashing the ball 500 feet into the cheap seats in a baseball match. And would we be as fascinated in the men's 100 if it was always going to be 1 in 10.1? I think I still would.
Yeah, it's about the competition.
I think I still would, because
times.
I'm still watching the competition. But I think a lot of people are hung up on world records and so forth. But anyway, let's park that.
Let's park it, yeah.
So some of the issues for track and field is, A, difficult to relate to. Malcolm Gladwell, I found this interesting, and I don't see eye to eye with Gladwell on a lot of things. Gladwell's an intellectual, he's an author in the US, he writes for New Yorker, and he's got 5 or 6 best-selling books. He's a very keen athlete.
Yes.
Really good miler.
I've had him run his wall once or twice.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he came up with something a couple of years ago called the Kipsang number. Have you seen this?
No.
It was at the time that the world record in the marathon was held by Wilson Kipsang. Mm. So today it wouldn't be that. It would be the Kemeto number or the Kipchoge number, whichever record you believe in. And he said the Kipsang number is how many meters or kilometers you could run at Wilson Kipsang's marathon world record pace. Because everyone has a Kipsang number. And his thinking was...
Mine's zero.
Well, 5 meters, surely.
Maybe.
Downhill, if you were...
Maybe.
If you were pushed hard in the back. Yeah. So, for instance, if you could run a half marathon at the world marathon record pace, then A, you'd be the best half marathon in South Africa, and B, your Kipsang number would be 21.1 kilometers.
Okay.
And so he was saying that would help people get an idea of just how impressive that performance was, because most people's Kipsang
number... So to give an idea, let's say, for instance, what is 1K?
257. Yeah.
So if you can run a 257-kilometer once off, which I definitely can't do.
Yeah, no, I would tear most muscles in my lower body.
So my Kipsang number would be like 500 meters, maybe.
So you're going to...
Maybe.
Well,
not even that.
Yeah, no. I'd struggle to make 400 at this stage. Yeah. I'm so unfit. You go down to the gym and get on a treadmill, make sure it's a decent one and someone's there to catch you behind, and you put the treadmill on 21.3 kilometers per hour.
Yeah.
And see what you feel like.
I don't think they even go up that high, do they?
They might not. Some of them might not. So, so that's the problem. And then the other thing is,
just sign the indemnity form first before we take your advice.
You didn't hear it on this podcast. So that's the one thing. And then the other is, it's not always easy to tell who's winning in track and field.
Yeah,
if field events have that problem.
Yeah, especially the stagger.
Yeah. So, men's 100 is really easy because even if you only watch one event every 4 years at the Olympics. Mm. It's very easy to see that guy's winning, he's the fastest, and so it's a little more complex.
I'd love to see, I mean, we've seen this before, you know, in post events where they'll show the speed of the athlete on the track as they're running, and they can mark that with a little, you know, graphic and that sort of thing. And it would be amazing to be able to do that in the 400, to actually show whoever's leading at that point would have like a little marker of them. So hopefully tomorrow night when Wade van Niekerk's racing, we can, you know, he goes off, if he's the quickest out, who then takes who's second and third continue.
Yeah,
it'd be amazing to watch that, and I agree.
Yeah.
Just a final word on this. I remember, I liked your point about the relevance, understanding the relevance. I was at home last night with my family trying to explain to my youngest son how far the long jumpers jumped. So I measured out across our lounge nine meters, which is almost what they were jumping on Saturday. And he was dumbfounded. I said, these guys actually jump that far in the air, completely in the air. They're not touching the ground at any point. That's how... He says, no, it's impossible. I said, this is a conservative. I just literally stepped out a meter at a time. So it gives you an idea. Just go and do that. Just measure out 1 meter, 9 meters, which is basically just one decent stride, and figure out that is exactly how far those guys are jumping. That's when relevance becomes like, whoa, that is amazing stuff.
Yeah, so on that, you're watching the men's long jump or shot put, whatever it is, pole vault last night for women. What's the difference between Manyonga jumping 8:48 and the American who's 4 centimeters behind? That's the margin of victory.
Yeah.
So what's the difference? Was it speed on the runway?
Yeah.
Who was faster, Manyonga or or Lawson? Is it the force being applied to the ground? Is it the angle of takeoff? Or is it the time they spend hanging in the air and what they... So those
that's why you're here.
Well, those are the four things that determine the outcome. Now, obviously, they're not linear and simple, but those are the four things. So if you were coaching these athletes, those are four things you measure.
Yeah.
And I was at a conference in 2012, and it was presented by a UK-based sports and exercise group, and they had speaking on their group from UK Athletics, and they employ a horizontal jumps specialist whose job it is to measure those things.
Okay.
And so they have force plates in the ground, they have high-speed cameras, and they're measuring the angle, the speed, the force all the time.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that we want to turn track and field into a NASA-like aeronautics experiment or demonstration, but I think it would be interesting to show what's the hang time. How long did this guy spend in the air? What's the height that Manyonga got compared to Lawson? Are they taking off at different...
Brilliant.
Those things, I think, for me, they would enhance the coverage. So that's the technology being used. The only other option I think they've got is some new events. And I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I was in the States for 10 weeks a while back, and every night there was a channel, and I assume they're just showing reruns of Ninja Warrior.
Yes.
Now, I hate the glam and the hype and the stupid commentary and so on, But I can see the appeal of a Ninja Warrior because it's an all-round athleticism. Mm. It's a simple concept. Mm. You either make it or you don't. You fall into the water and the crocodiles or whatever. I like some sort of obstacle type thing would be interesting. You know, climbing is going to be in the Olympics in 2020. So you're going to have two guys climbing a wall as fast as possible next to one another. Mm. So it's a match race. It's a duel, basically. Mm. That would be quite interesting in a track and field sense, but you've got to get it right without being gimmicky and stupid. But that seems to me to be what the market wants more of.
The tricky thing is, you know, I always think of track and field's a bit like the Olympics. It's all about an Olympic ideal of faster, higher, stronger, and that's why sometimes people struggle to understand the field events because you know, there's how many implements are you going to throw or chuck. You know, they've defined what those implements are now, and they've been around for years and years. But, you know, what happens if somebody decides to throw a bed? Well, you know, could there be a bed throwing championship? That's always the tricky bit, and that's where the Wheel of Relevance comes in.
Yeah. So, again, there's this, we've referenced it a couple of times on this podcast. They're doing this big biomechanics study. Mm. So, at some point, there will be data on the velocity of the discus release and the javelin and the shot put and the hammer throw.
Yeah.
So we'll get data on like who's actually the most powerful.
Yeah.
So
it'll be great.
So that's cool to add insight, but it's not exactly enhancing the coverage. I mean, in the end, sport needs characters and personalities and rivalries. Mm. Tennis is healthy because there are four guys who've been dueling. Golf was healthy because Tiger Woods was such a personality. He grew the commercial value of golf by orders. I mean, it doubled it potentially. Yeah. So sport needs to market those kind of guys, and so another problem for track and field is it is so global that it's quite difficult to do that.
Okay, so let us know what your thoughts are. Don't forget, if you are listening to this podcast live, you're very welcome to interact with us on Twitter or Facebook and ask us some questions. We'll get to those. We're just going to wrap up with just a bit of a preview of tonight. Quite a lot of stuff happening, some interest obviously from a South African perspective, but the 1500 meter final. Big story there, of course, Caster Semenya. Can she win probably the most difficult of her two potential golds in this World Championships?
We said before, most interesting event of the games, the championships. It was before, because there are four absolute studs running in that. Dibaba, Hassan, Kipyegon, and Laura Muir. So that was going to be a massive duel. And now you add Semenya, and even if she doesn't come in the top four, she's changing that race because tactically they have to do different things. And so she's looked ominously good in the heats and the semi. I've given up a long...
She wasn't that good in the semi there, Caster.
I've given up a long time ago of trying to judge whether Caster Semenya is taking it easy or not. It's just impossible. She ran a 400 a few weeks ago where she came 7th or 8th and she looked like she wasn't trying. Now, you can't be jogging...
No.
To come 7th in a 400. So she's very difficult to gauge. But I think she looked really good. I mean, she only needed to come top 5. And so she's 3rd and she's looking at the screen and she's saying, why race these girls now? Yeah. Like, we'll save that for Monday. So if they are going to go out in anything like for the first lap, 64, 65, no problem for her.
Yeah.
If the second lap goes to 68... Even 65, 66, she's there. She's happy.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I make her almost the favorite.
Okay.
So
watch those splits tonight.
Yeah. If the first 800 is 2.9, 2.10, Caster Semenya's relatively comfortable and just waiting for the bell. So someone has got to do something really aggressive. And the Ethiopian Dibaba came 2nd in the Olympics. She tried to win that race by going suicidally fast in the 3rd lap. It would be necessary to do that again tonight, but she looked really poor in the semi. That helps Semenya as well. So who takes it on, you know? And again, those top four are so closely matched that whoever takes it on is making a massive gamble.
Yeah.
Because the other three are good enough that they will just beat her.
Yeah.
But one of them has to take it on, because if they don't, Semenya beats all of them. So it's poker tonight.
So in a way, Caster's depending on that, I guess...
Risk aversion.
Yeah.
So that's going to be, for me, really, really fascinating. And I wouldn't want to... I still think Kipyegon or Hassan wins gold. I reckon Semenya gets a medal. But as I said, I've given up years ago trying to forecast what Semenya's going to do. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
Except in the eighth, she's going to win.
I mean, we can't talk about every single event, obviously, but just quickly, Wade van Niekerk, the 400-meter world record holder and Olympic champion and lots of other stuff that he's done, going for the 200-meter heats tonight. This is the challenge for him. He's racing the 400 tomorrow. He still has to race 200 heats tonight. What faces him?
So where most of his 400 rivals are not relaxing today but doing their fine-tuning, he has to go through... Okay, and it's only a heat, so he's not going to have to run 19.8. He's going to run 20.3 or something, and he'll make it.
Yeah.
But he's got to go through the warm-up and the stadium activities. And so that's where it gets demanding. And so he will have to conserve energy. I read an interview with him on the internet this morning where he says he's got these doubts versus belief in his mind. He called it this constant tension, which was interestingly candid, actually. Mm. And he said he's nervous about the physical demand that he's asking of himself. But he did then say that he has been trying to manage his efforts in the 400, which is why he hasn't looked, in my opinion, dominant. I still think he's looking good enough that he's going to run 43.4 or faster, and that's going to win that title.
Yeah.
As for tonight, he's just got to do as little as possible to get to the next round, and then one step at a time. So that'll be interesting. There've been some other guys looking good in the four, but for me in the semis last night, he looked like he was doing just enough to clear the bar, which is perfect.
Now, we started this podcast talking a little bit about the sad topic of drugs, but we're going to go and hopefully end it with something really positive. The 100-meter final hurdles, 110-meter hurdles.
Yeah.
Great story with the world champion and the world record holder coming back from a lot of adversity.
Yeah, so in 2012 in London, the Olympic champion was Aries Merritt,
who then... American, by the way.
An American hurdler, high hurdler.
With great hair.
Yeah, a lot of them have that.
Fantastic. It's like a map up there. You know? Anyway, we're digressing.
And at least it's streamlined.
Yes. Nothing's flapping in the breeze there.
It's interesting because I've been watching, especially on the women's side, a lot of them have very big, and I would imagine heavy hair. And I know this sounds sort of facetious, but if you could give me 500 grams less to carry in a 100, I mean...
Is that how much hair is worth?
I don't know how much does a weave
weigh? Am I heavier than you because I have more hair?
Well,
I don't know. Be faster over 5K?
I don't know, but I mean, if you gave those women 200 grams to carry on their shoulders, they would say no way. But they're choosing to have... If anyone out there knows how much...
How much hair is worth?
The women's heptathlon was won by Tiam of Belgium, who's got impressive hair.
Yeah.
And I would like to know how much that weighs, because I wouldn't, as an athlete, want to carry it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in cycling, they don't paint their bicycle because they're so obsessed about weight. Track and field doesn't seem to have made that OCD leap yet.
That's the one thing about track and field which I think is actually amazing, is how amazing these athletes look. That's one thing about athletics that I don't think they've ever taken advantage of. I mean, these are the best bodies in sport, male and female. You know, you just have to watch the events, the women's pole vault last night. I mean, it's amazing. So you kind of, I'm not to say that we should be looking at sport in terms of just what the sex appeal level of it is, but, you know, these athletes are probably in the best shape of any sport. I mean, I can't think of a better sport maybe other than boxers that have all-round physical fitness.
Some events. Right? I mean, and that's... So, Aries Merritt, we'll get back to you. some events. One of the most interesting things to me as a physiologist, and my friend David Epstein is an American journalist. I'm sure you've heard the name. He's an investigative guy, but he's written a book called The Sports Gene. And in that book, he dedicates a lot of time to talking about body types. And track and field is the most unbelievable... showroom for different body types, because you compare a shot put athlete to a high jumper to a sprinter to a distance runner, and you see these vastly different body types. And if you then introduce other sports, swimming compared to running, different. Like, so Hisham Al Gharouj is a Moroccan miler, 1500 guy, holds the world record in the mile.
One of the greats.
Michael Phelps is obviously the greatest Olympic swimmer and medalist.
Got beaten by a shark recently, though.
Yes. A virtual digital CGI shark. Those guys, David's found this out. Al Gharouj is 175 tall, centimeters. and Phelps 193. So there's 18 centimeters difference in height between them.
Mm-hmm.
And they wear the same length pants.
Yeah.
So that means that the entire 18 centimeter difference is in the upper body.
Okay.
And so Phelps is a long upper body and shorter, relatively short legs.
Yeah.
Whereas Al Guerrouj is relatively long legs and a short body. So one of them was born to swim, because that's what you need, short legs, long body.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was born to run.
Mm.
And the women's 400 semis are tonight. The men's 400 is tomorrow. You look at some of those athletes, especially Shaunae Miller-Weber from the women's side, and Stephen Gardner of the Bahamas on the men's side. Just the most unbelievable physique for that event.
Yeah.
So I find that really, really fascinating to look at. The length of the tendons, they've got longer legs relative to... It's really, for me, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the Kenyans sort of, you know, they're built for... They can't produce a sprinter, but goodness me, they can run endurance events.
Asbel Kiprop in the 1500 is... He looks like a... He's been stretched on a rack.
Yeah.
But it's... If you were designing with an engineer and a physiologist a distance runner, that's what he'd come out the factory looking like. So it's... I find track and fields fascinating for that reason.
It's always amazing to me that there's some athletes that will say, you know, 100 meter athletes or 200 meter athletes. I remember talking to Onal Mohiba, the South African record holder over the 400 meters many years ago, and towards the end of his career he was trying to think, you know, should he go 800? And he never did, because the difference between a 400 and 800 is enormous in terms of his physiology. And I used to think, why doesn't he just... If he's so fast over 400, surely an 800 with a bit of endurance training would be accessible to him. But it wasn't. And that's how narrowly defined these different events are.
Yeah, so he'd be better than 99.5% of the world at 800.
Yeah.
But he's not good enough, because the people in the world champs are the 0.2% of the world who are the best ones. So, and the crossover is...
Yeah.
That's why when you get doubles, the 1-2 most common, 2-4 a little rarer, 8-15, 5-10. So the 5-10 it's the same physiology. The 4-8 is not, because and that's stuff you can't see. It's not the muscles and the it's the stuff that's happening in the muscles, the metabolism and the biochemistry. That's what makes the difference. So Wade at 1-2-4, people are saying, oh, let him run 8. Imagine how good... No, doesn't work that way. Doesn't work. So, really interesting.
Back to Aries Merritt.
So, Aries Merritt is the Olympic champ in 2012. He breaks the world record by a lot, like obscene amount in 2012, just after the Olympics. He then doesn't do too well in 2013, but in 2015 comes third at the world champs. 4 days after that final, has a kidney transplant, because he's got... He's got a congenital kidney condition called focal segmental glomerulosis. I read up on this the other day.
Yeah. Spell it? No, I'm joking.
FSG.
We haven't got time to spell it.
That's FSG.
FSG.
And so he comes third and has a kidney transplant. Mm. So that's quite an amazing story. And that was 2 years ago, and now he's back, and he looked good in round one, not as good in the semi. But he, by virtue of his pedigree, will be one of the favorites for that. The other guys there are Omar McLeod of Jamaica, always US-Jamaica. So far it's 2-0 USA in the sprints, but this is potentially Jamaica's one.
Okay.
So that'll be interesting, and that's tonight as well. So look out for that. The hurdles is very difficult to call, because... You make an error of judgment or technique, and you clip a hurdle, and you lose momentum, and you go from first to seventh like this. So
I think it's probably the most amazing event, just because you have to be really brave. I mean, you have to attack every single hurdle and get it spot on.
When you watch it from the front, you watch the slow motions after the final, then you appreciate the height and what they're doing. Because look at their hips. You see, you're not doing this.
No, you're not jumping.
They call it modified sprinting, because your hips should not move too much. And so I saw the slammers yesterday, McLeod and Merritt there. I mean, obviously you're moving a little bit because the hurdle's that high, but it's impressive from the front. It's physically and technically one of the best, the most impressive things you'll see in the sport.
Okay, so lots to look forward to tonight. We're going to wrap it up for today and be back with you tomorrow. We've got one question which... Ross is going to...
So this is interesting, because it feeds into what we were talking about a moment ago, and it's Tony Flynn again. So that's 2 out of 2 for tonight. Thank you. Glynis, I'm going to get to your question in the... I'll write something down. He says, horse racing coverage does not use speed and times at all, which is true. They don't... You don't have the Kentucky Derby where they have a world record like counter. Mm-hmm. Betting prices are more important than personal bests to broaden appeal. And that's interesting because a few people, including athletes, have said that if you want to broaden the appeal of track and field, you should allow betting on the athletes. The problem with athletes is that unlike horses, they can make decisions. And so you can get, how do you regulate that market? Because you put $100 on on Bolt to win and
race
someone else pays Bolt more. And you get, so that's that's the reason they've resisted it. But he's right. If you did that, people would be drawn to it because they're engaged. And and that's key, is how do you engage people? Money and betting works.
So maybe not for the right reasons though.
No, 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 not at all. And and again, can you overcome the the issues with with fixing? Maybe not.
No, we've got enough scandals to deal with in athletics.
Yeah.
Right, that wraps it up for today. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock to give you some review of what happened tonight, which is going to be very exciting, and of course looking towards the events tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget to interact with us on Twitter and Runners World South Africa, and also with Ross's Science of Sport, and I'm on Mike Finch SA, and we'll be loading the podcast up on our Facebook page and on our site a bit later on, where you can literally plug it into your car and listen to it on the way home from work this afternoon ahead of the events now. Ross, thanks very much for your time.
Thank
you. We'll be chatting to you guys tomorrow.
Enjoy. Cheers.